Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan welcoming again the most wonderful audience in the entire field of mental health, psychology. Oh, gosh, so many fields, too many to mention. I really appreciate this time to talk with you again. And, of course, to have you downloading this show, as you do, in the hundreds of thousands now on a daily basis. Thank you for that. We'll try to keep this the most cutting-edge, informative show in the field. Well, my guest today is going to have a fair amount to say about some of the following issues. First, the CDC has recently come out with guidelines that really slam what they call the overuse of pain medications, the opiates, the overuse of the opiates. Now, you'd think I might immediately think that was a good idea, overuse of the opiates. I'm not a big fan of medication. Well, nobody wants to see the overuse of opiates, but I and my wife Ginger have long suspected it's much more complicated than that, because why do the opiates get slammed? Because it's not the first time. And we suspect that one of the reasons is that there's a lot other newer, more expensive drugs, $1,000 a month drugs and more, that they want to substitute for the opiates. Well, not very long after the CDC comes out and actually is interfering in medical care, basically suggesting new guidelines for opiate treatment, giving very specific drug doses, by the way, that they think are too high. Not long after, April 22nd, 5 days ago, pain medicine news, olanzapine shows analgesic properties may help reduce chronic pain. What's olanzapine? It's Zyprexa. And boy, they have a lot of evidence for this new thing. There's this fellow, Xavier Jimenez, at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. And he's a psychiatrist. He's been working in medical settings, and he uses these atypical antipsychotics frequently, not just to treat psychosis. He uses them for mood, sleep, anxiety, etc. The etc. is actually in the quote, says this doctor, whose name is spelled J-I-M-E-N-E-Z. He even says that some palliative doctors and oncologists use these as a sort of last-ditch resort medications. And then the next line is a headline. It says advertisement. I'm not just sure how this is organized. And out comes olanzapine. Oh, it's Dr. Jimenez again talking about how quite specifically it's not just the atypicals that may be good, but really it's olanzapine, Zyprexa. And he did this exhaustive study about the atypicals and pain. And out of this exhaustive study, he gets apparently, because he hasn't mentioned one, not a single statistically significant result, but in a lot of areas like fibromyalgia and headache and migraine, the only one study was in headache, we have some evidence, he says, level one evidence, he says, without citing anything more specific, that what? Olanzapine might be a little better. Makes you wonder, doesn't it, folks? The cleverness of Eli Lilly, whom I've known for a long time, been attacked by them many, many times, have been highly critical of them and their drugs many, many times. But the one thing you can't fault them for is cleverness in finding new markets. You wonder if they had some influence on the CDC stepping so far out of bounds as to start setting up guidelines for prescribing medications that would in the long run favor Zyprexa by cutting back on the most effective treatments for pain. But it doesn't end there. They not only want to get you when you're overwhelmed with pain, they want to get you when you're overwhelmed with death. And so we got another thing coming out, that olanzapine might be really, really effective because it has these metabolic pathways that are similar to the opiates. I mean, this is all new stuff. This is very exciting, and it might be useful on your deathbed. Yeah. I can't get too cynical about drug companies. I'll be telling you more and more about this, but it's impossible to get too cynical about drug companies. My guest, Richard Red Lawhorn. Red, are you there?
Yeah, I'm with you.
You're listening. Now, Richard is a very interesting man. I'd use doctor, but we don't use that on our show because he's a volunteer. He's a retired systems engineering guy. And my wife loves engineers. She just loves engineering guys. She's got a lot of engineer. Her dad's was an engineer. And she's got a lot of engineer in her. And anyhow, one of the things, just as a start, that Richard Red Lawhorn exemplifies is how can a person make a difference? How can a person get interested in something, care about something for personal reasons perhaps, become an expert even without a degree in the area and make a big difference? And that's exactly what Red Lawhorn has done, L-A-W-H-E-R-N. He became interested in agonizing face pain back in 1996. And it had to do, I believe, with his wife at the time.
Right.
And it led him to study the medical literature. You see, any intelligent person can bring zeal, zest, and ethics. Don't forget the ethics. On the one hand, you have Eli Lilly and J&J and Upjohn. On the other hand, you have ethical research. You know, we used to talk about ethical pharmacy, ethical firms. The word was practically synonymous with pharmacology firms. Boy, has that gone away. He studied the medical literature. He became a webmaster and then a board member of the U.S. Trigeminal Neuralgia Association for a while. He co-authored the first worldwide survey of chronic face pain patients. He's been providing a lot of online research, doing referrals, giving emotional support, now in the thousands to chronic face pain patients. He's worked through WebMD, which is, by the way, it's basically an arm of the pharmaceutical industry, About.com, the USTN Association, places I don't know about. I need to learn. Ben's Friends Online, I'm sure these are all about pain disorders. He's the author of the most recent edition of the Trigeminal Neuralgia Fact Sheet at the U.S. Institutes for Neurological Disorders and Stroke. That's Nines, N-I-N-D-S. I want to ask him maybe at the start, how in the world did he get to the position where he could be writing a fact sheet for one of the major health organizations, agencies of the federal government? I've addressed them in the way back, decades ago, read about psychosurgery, and they actually seem more rational than some of the other agencies. Anyway, he's just been doing a lot. He's an extremely thoughtful man. I'm not sure whether we'll end up agreeing on a lot of things or a few things or whether it won't matter, but it's a perfect time to have an expert on concerning the treatment of chronic pain, given the slamming of the opiates by the CDC, and then the leaping into the fray with a new offer for folks who want pain relief, along with a lobotomy, a chemical lobotomy from Zyprexa. Take over, my friend. Take over.
Okay. You want a little bit about the background story on the work I did with NINDS. I got into the overall patient support and support group environment because my wife had had trigeminal neuralgia diagnosed in the late 1990s and had a really rough time with it. The first neurologist that we saw basically said, well, I think you've got this rather rare disorder. I don't have any literature on it here in my office, but I'm going to refer you and give you a phone number for the U.S. Trigeminal Neuralgia Association, and they will probably have a great deal more for you. Well, that's kind of an interesting indicator by itself. It turns out that this disorder causes medically the worst pain that is known in neurological practice. I have seen people since I got into this milieu who have been struck by an attack in public and have folded up into a fetal ball on the floor, holding their face with both hands and desperately trying to avoid crying because the pain is so severe that they are afraid it will get worse if they do. And I happened to be reading in NINDS one day, and this was probably, I guess, 4 years ago or so. This was after I'd had a lot of experience in working with patients, a lot of experience in reading the literature and supporting various venues. And I read the fact sheet, and it was outdated. It did not reflect current knowledge at the time of the treatments of trigeminal neuralgia that are known. And I felt that it was very silent on an issue that is embedded in this particular disorder, which is that it has two basically different forms. One of them produces volleys of lightning strike stabs. It's almost like it being on the end of an electric cattle prod. And the other has more of a character of systemic pain that's typical of neuropathy. Literally, injury to a nerve, and it's, you know, throbbing, burning, boring pain that is sometimes called atypical trigeminal neuralgia. But the TN fact sheet at NINDS was completely silent on it. So I looked up their Office of Information, and I sent them a list of my credits in terms of work that had been published in places where I had contributed. I basically said, guys, you need to have somebody take a look at this fact sheet because it's dated. And I got back a very nice letter from a guy in their office, and he basically said, well, yeah, we know we needed to have it updated, but so far we haven't been able to find anybody to do it. Would you be interested? And I said, sure. And he said, the requirement we have is once you write it, since you don't have a formal medical degree, you'll have to have it validated by someone outside of NINDS who does. And that was easy because I have a lot of acquaintances who are in one way or another doctors. And I could look somebody up and do that. So I took on the job of developing a newer and somewhat more representative fact sheet. Along about the same time, I read the article on atypical TN at Wikipedia. I sucked in a long, hard breath and said, whoa, this is not only incomplete, but it's wrong. And so I dug in and got myself registered with the Wikipedia folks and massively rewrote the document. And it's still in the form that I rewrote it, still up, and hasn't been changed since. So I was able to do some good in bringing currency to the information that is represented to people who are trying to find out, what's this thing happening to me? Now, another element of all this, and part of what kind of leads me to your forum today, is that I started talking with chronic pain patients. And I started encountering numbers of them who, for one reason or another, had been written off as head cases by their doctors. Doctors who didn't understand what they were going through, didn't recognize what it was, in many cases, and who basically said to them, in one way or another, I can find no medical explanation for the symptoms you're reporting to me, and I don't know what to recommend for you that will be a safe treatment, so I think it would be wise for you to be evaluated by a psychiatrist for possible psychosomatic issues, which is another way of saying, I don't believe your pain, I think you're faking. And in some cases, it's not quite as blatant as this commonly, but in some cases, these doctors basically said to their patients, this is all in your head. If you change your attitude, you won't be in pain anymore. And as soon as I saw that, my alarm bells went off. And I started researching another branch of literature, which we discussed now about 2 years ago when I was on your program, which is the mental health literature that pertains to issues like somatic symptom disorder in the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or its predecessor, which was called psychogenic pain syndrome. And basically, these are invented disorders that represent what I regard to be a professionalized delusional system on the part of psychiatrists, because they say that chronic pain can be created by the condition of a person's depression, independently of any physical cause. And that's nonsense. It's outright nonsense. And so I started digging hard and doing more research in that area. That, in turn, led me to become associated with organizations such as the U.S. Pain Foundation recently, and to start looking at standards of treatment and standards of diagnosis and assessment for people who are in chronic pain that maybe isn't face pain. It's a larger issue in a wider sense. I got some real shocks when I started doing that. The estimate, I've never seen the source of it, but I think from everything I can determine that it's probably a pretty good one. The estimate is that there are 100 million chronic pain patients in America. People with face pain are a very small slice of that population. And this is a population that is one of the worst stigmatized and abused of anybody that comes into medical offices or into mental health offices, for that matter, because there's issues there too. And part of that, and the part that led you to invite me to join you today, is the new standard. I should say not standard. It's guideline as it is published, although in fact it is a standard. The guidelines that the Centers for Disease Control have published concerning prescription of opioids for chronic pain in primary care environments other than a terminal or cancer pain. Apparently they didn't want to meddle with that particular branch of pharmacy and doctor assessment of patients. So they basically looked at something that was intended to be everything else, and they issued a standard. And that standard is one of the least trusted and most reviled among chronic pain patients of any that medical establishment has yet produced. There was a survey done just recently, again hosted by the U.S. Pain Foundation, where over 3,000 patients were responded to an online survey offer, and 94% of them registered the opinion that the new standards will be the result will result in the reduction of access to needed medications and the reduction of standards of care for pain patients throughout the United States. And there are similar issues embedded in that. So I got in, I read the standards, and I said, gosh, they're right. Because what we are now observing, and I'm seeing it in the patients that I most directly support in Facebook and other social media, patients are being discharged by their doctors who refuse to continue prescriptions for opioid medications that have been effective and well managed for years, that have never been abused, that have never caused any symptom that is remotely like addiction, and that are absolutely necessary for those patients to maintain any quality of life. In effect, what the CDC has done is they have thrown millions of chronic pain patients under a bus because they've issued a very unbalanced and, I think, factually incorrect guideline on standards of care that has been entirely too strongly influenced by the war on drugs by DEA. So I've been rattling on now for just a bit, Peter, so I should turn this back over to you and let you see where you want to amplify.
Well, I think first, that's kind of a stunning notion of 100 million people, because that's a third of the population, including infants and the elderly. So it would indicate that not one out of three, but maybe one out of two people, because you know, if you take out especially the children, the young people, you take out quite a few.
I don't know for sure.
One out of every two or three people has got chronic pain. But I don't think we need to quibble over it, because you say you don't know the origin of it. I certainly think that an awful lot of people have chronic pain. I don't know if it's 50 million or 100 million, but a lot of people have chronic. Yes, go ahead.
It's big numbers. I can give you some examples. The big contributors would be 5 million fibromyalgia patients, which is a stat that is acknowledged by the NINDS. Well over that number, and probably on the order of 20 to 30 million failed back syndrome patients.
Oh, I think it's more than that are back people. Yeah,
right.
I can believe that easily. I think most hardworking men, have back issues.
Yeah, but we need to make some distinction between people who have the kind of low back pain that a chiropractor can help, and people who go through multiple operations, laminectomies, surgical procedures for the correction of scoliosis and things like it. Procedures.
And you're estimating how many, or the estimates are how many for those kind of people?
I'm going to have to plead some ignorance, because I'm not sure I've seen reliable stats, but it's certainly in the tens of millions.
Yes.
On average, about 50% of all operations that are done for things like a failed disc fail. The patient is left with lingering pain that has to be managed never gets better. And that's a stat that I do trust. Orthopedic surgery has not been successful, particularly for a great number of people. So, yeah, the 100 million number is a stunning statistic. It is one that I don't take without a measure of reserve.
Okay. But I just wanted to address that, because I think you say so many things that are on really solid ground that I want to make clear that that's somebody else's estimate. Now, this is so important what you're saying. You're saying that doctors have gotten scared off by these CDC issues.
Right.
I remember that the CDC was setting some kind of limit in their mind beyond which doctors better have darn good reasons for going, and how many milligram equivalents of morphine you were giving a day. I don't have that offhand. Is that the kind of thing that's scaring them?
I don't have it on my desk, but I can find it easily enough.
Yeah, why don't you get that number? But you think that in itself is scaring doctors off of their patients?
Well, yes and no. What's really scaring doctors away from their patients is the likelihood that if they make large numbers of prescriptions for chronic pain patients among the opiates, that tracking systems will flag them as potential pill mills.
Yes.
And even pain management practices are dropping out because they read the guidelines and they read things, for instance, like these opioid equivalent dose numbers, which I think is on the order of 50 milligrams per day. I may be wrong on that. That's something that floats to the surface for me. But you're talking numbers that are very restricted relative to what is commonly used in people who are dealing with severe chronic pain. And I've talked to patients who have had their long prescriptions either turned off completely without assistance, without referral, or reduced by factors of like reduced by half or by three quarters or more from levels that they have been on previously, and levels that were at least in some moderate sense effective in helping them maintain a quality of life and independence. So I've also talked with doctors who have basically said, and when I say talk with, I mean I've communicated with by email largely or in online postings. I've talked with doctors who are basically telling me, right now, these standards are being used as a basis for DEA interest and harassment of both doctors and pharmacies, with the intention of trying to reduce the number of prescription opioid-related accidental deaths. And that opens another can of worms, because when you look at the claims that are being made in terms of the rising numbers of opioid deaths, you find all kinds of confounding factors. Let me give you one example, or a few examples. Most deaths by prescription... Yeah, excuse me, my dog is barking.
That's
here.
All right. They, my most folks deaths hear that by sometimes prescription in the background, drugs, too. Go ahead.
Yeah. Sorry?
That's okay. Sometimes people hear my dogs barking, okay, too. Go ahead,
right,
with
right,
what you
She's
say.
She's not medicated.
You're
anyway
talking about complicating things that go into these very high death rates from opioid,
right,
poisonings that the CDC is citing since 1999, these large,
right,
numbers.
Right.
And you're saying that's more complicated than meets the eye.
Right. Well, for instance, most deaths, the cause of death is assigned by medical examiners. And in over half of the U.S. states, the only thing that a medical examiner needs is a high school diploma, believe it or not, at least formally. It's not usually the case that somebody with that little education will be selected. But in most states, medical examiners operate part-time. They operate with huge backlogs. And they don't have routine access. They don't have routine access to blood toxicology testing because it's not routinely done. And even if they had access to it, a number of the medications that are used under prescription are chemically indistinguishable from heroin or from other on-street illegal meds.
Mm.
Talk about one other nasty complication. The drug companies, or excuse me, the drug cartels that want to maintain control of their market in addicts and abusers are now releasing from Mexico pills that are basically street heroin by another name, but they are pills that are built around the manufacture under uncontrolled conditions of fentanyl, which is an opiate that is used in patches for pain control. But when taken in pill form, it can deliver a dose that is 100 times more powerful than morphine, and it's killing people, and it's killing them,
yeah,
in numbers. So counterfeit drugs add to the, it's almost a morass, it's a swamp of perceptions and issues and problems where I would have to say, frankly, that there is an awful lot of hysteria operating on the part of both medical authorities and law enforcement concerning a so-called epidemic that I'm not convinced is an epidemic at all of drug-related deaths. And I'm specifically not convinced that it is prescription drug-related deaths. I've seen references to claims by DEA, and I'm not sure these references are direct. I've never seen the original documents, but I've seen references that suggest that the number of prescription drug-related deaths is now more than the number of automobile accident-related deaths, and that would be about 35,000 a year.
Yes.
But I've seen other quite credible publications that indicate that the number of deaths is probably less than half that due to prescription drugs, and several times that with regard to street heroin and illegal drugs. And you've got people that are arguing without ever quoting their sources. That's never going to be helpful, and it specifically is as unscientific as the Dickens. And when you get deeply into the CDC standards, you find out that conditions are not a whole lot better there, because there's acknowledgement in the standards that in many cases, the studies that they have uncovered and researched produced relatively weak medical evidence for some of their conclusions. And there's lots of other things with this whole process that are, frankly, they stink. They stink of incompetence on the part of the CDC and its consulting advisory group. They stink of undue influence, because the advisory group that ultimately wrote this new standard didn't include a single board-certified pain management specialist, and there were no patients accessed, even though there were public comments solicited. And some of the meetings that the consulting group held were held in secret, which is a direct violation of public law. There's a transparency law that governs how the CDC and FDA conduct their standards setting and guideline setting process. And the process is supposed to involve public meetings and published minutes of public meetings uniformly to maintain transparency of the process, so that people can see how people got, you know, how the experts got to their conclusions. And that didn't happen in the case of at least two of the meetings that were involved in writing and negotiating this standard. Now, look at the picture and what you get, and this I have confidence of because I've talked to patients who are involved in it. What you're getting is thousands of people who are being unilaterally cut off from opioid treatments that are the only treatments that for them as individuals stands between them and suicide. We're dealing with a level of pain that literally closes people down, throws them into enormous deep depression, and they effectively socially lose their lives when they have to deal with this pain. Some of them can't get out of bed. Many of them have relationships disrupted. Some of them are rendered homeless by the inability to work. That is, I think, fairly rare, but it still does happen. I've talked with patients who walked into their doctor's office to renew a prescription that had been effective for 5 years, and they were told, well, no, I can't do that anymore. And when they pressed for answers, what they got back was, well, the amount of medication you're getting has to be tapered back, because if I continue to prescribe it, I'll be harassed by the DEA. And I may have my license pulled. As a matter of fact, I've talked with at least one doctor who did have his license pulled for prescribing too many opiates. And he was a pain management specialist, but he was still challenged and essentially prosecuted by DEA for prescribing the only things that work. And patients right now are literally at the level of alarm that says, I don't want to use that term on the air. We're being seriously abused by a federal government that doesn't give a rip about our welfare. And the CDC has taken the lead on what amounts to a war on chronic pain patients. And if you hear a little bit of ardor and deeply felt feeling behind that from me, you're getting a pretty accurate picture, because I think chronic pain patients got the short end of this deal. Very badly so.
Yeah, some of the data, some of you may have heard in the background some audio, which I didn't quite realize as I was checking out some of the figures that are being claimed. They're talking about 28,000 deaths from people involving opiates. There we go again.
And, what kind of opiates?
Well, they're throwing in heroin. So the implication is that this is somehow related to pain treatment. Well, I'm sure some pain patients eventually turn to heroin, but I don't think that's the majority of what's going on. So they're lumping together heroin, which is one of the points you're making. And then they've got another big figure, 1.9 million people abused or dependent on opiates. I mean, what kind of figure is that? I mean, anybody who takes a pain medicine is dependent on it.
Yeah, there's another subtlety, and it's important. To be dependent on opiates is not to abuse them. People who are taking opiates for severe chronic pain do not get a high when they take these drugs, even if they become physically dependent at a level that produces withdrawal symptoms when they're cut short. So what we've got is doctors who are equating two conditions that do not equate. They are not addiction. Addiction and dependency are not the same medical entity. Then you have layered on that doctors who are either equating or failing to distinguish between deaths from heroin or things like it and deaths from misuse of prescription drugs, very often in association with alcohol. And that's one of the major contributing elements in many of these deaths.
Yeah,
And likewise, the use of multi-pharmacy is sometimes a contributing factor, because you get drugs that interact and that doctors may not realize interact. That does happen. It's not a huge number out of roughly 13,000 deaths that are attributed to prescription drugs. So what you have here is all of the makings of a serious mess. And the mess is one that I am personally deeply concerned, as it progresses further, is being complicated by very restrictive state laws in places like Montana and Indiana, in New York, for that matter. There's a recent article here that I read from I believe it was a pharmacist in Montana, who says patients that used to come to him are no longer able to come to him because of the changes in policy with regard to how prescriptions are dispensed and the conditions under which a patient has to essentially verify and prove that they're not an addict before they can get renewals. And patients are being forced to fly out of the state of Montana to get care, who have had care and had adequate care for years. They're being cut off. And they're being cut off because doctors see the new guidelines and they say, this is just one step away from putting my tail in jail. And they know that the government is not, they in this case, the patients, they know that the government is not sincere in giving lip service to the idea that if you really have genuine chronic pain for reasons other than drug abuse or drug addiction, that you really should be treated when the conditions prevail on it. Or excuse me, when the conditions indicate that that is, in fact, the only medical treatment that makes sense for you. They don't trust that kind of assertion because they don't see doctors behaving that way. People are being, people, what's lost in a lot of this is that people come to treatment by opioids. After they go through years of attempts to use other measures that aren't opioids. The idea that somebody can go to a doctor and say, I've got this horrible backache, I need something for it, and immediately get an opioid, that has probably never been widespread, and it's even less so now. It's not common because there are dangers in opioid drugs at high doses, and they're recognized dangers. And doctors know darn well that if they start prescribing opioids for every little thing or for all of their patients, that they're going to have attention devoted to what they're doing, and that they should have that attention devoted to what they're doing, because other things do operate, and there are other treatments available that need to be tried first. So
Red,
let's
expand some of the subtlety here. How much of a serious problem do you think the opioid mill doctor is? Because we hear a lot about that. Do you think it's a big problem, doctors who are just making a living handing out scripts for the opioids? By which we mean the addictive pain meds.
Right. And there's one article I read recently that I think is unusually insightful in that regard. The Los Angeles Times medical editor, between I think it was 2012 and 2014, did an independent study in which they sent reporters to review the death statistics and the physician records of all of the drug-related deaths that had occurred in three counties around Los Angeles for a period of, I think, a month or 2 months. And they had a rather interesting finding. 20% of the deaths that had occurred in those counties were associated with 2% of the doctors. And the doctors themselves were in pain management practices of various types. But the numbers of patients that those doctors took on was unusually high. And there was grounds for seriously doubting that appropriate follow-up and oversight was being exercised on the ways those people were using drugs, or for that matter, on the original disorders that had caused them to go to a pain management specialist in the first place. So when you ask the question, are pill mills a problem? The answer is a qualified yes, but, and the but's important, there's been a lot of DEA activity and a lot of focus and attention given to this issue in the last 5 years. And I would have to say that pill mills are significantly less a problem now than they were 5 years ago.
Well, there's so much control now over prescribing practices. In New York State, where I am, which is not everywhere, but here, if you're giving a scheduled drug, that is a drug that has addictive potential, you have to check on a state system to see if this patient's been getting them somewhere else before as a part of your treatment process.
And that's true in a lot of the other states too.
And one of the things that's actually resulted in, which is very relevant to what you're saying and kind of reinforces it, and I haven't thought some of this through previously, Red, and that is that we have increasing problems of heroin addiction throughout America because by controlling doctors, which we do need to do, I think we do need to have some kind of something to prevent a lot of doctor shopping. But by imposing those restraints, people aren't getting their meds and they're addicted and they've got terrible problems with their addiction. They end up going to heroin because they can't doctor shop. It's kind of an irony because we certainly want to prevent doctor shopping where you go from one doctor to another to support your addiction. But then you use the state's power to limit that, then you're ending up with a lot of heroin deaths that are a direct result of that control. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. And if I may, I'll tell you a little story that a patient told me. This is something that she witnessed herself. And I have every reason to believe that what she reported was factual. Her cousin had been a long-time chronic pain patient and was cut off from very high doses of two of the opiates by his doctor. The doctor refused to give him referral for the management of withdrawal symptoms. His blood pressure went through the roof. He started having incidents of projectile vomiting, and I'm sorry for your audience if any of that is disturbing, but that's what happened. Started having incidents of projectile vomiting. He had an incident in which he fell in the shower while he was nauseous, and he aspirated some of his own throw-up, and it put him into coma. He wasn't discovered until 2 days later. If he recovers or if he is maintained at his current state, will be a vegetable for the rest of his life. And the physician who cut him off cannot be prosecuted because the physician was operating under the standards set by the CDC. That has actually happened, and I don't think it's a single case. I think it's happening in more places than one. I've heard from at least five patients in the last 10 days who have been cut off from opiate medication without withdrawal support of any kind, and they're basically being told to suck it up, or they're being avoided by their physicians and by their physician staffs out of something that seems to resemble a kind of horrified embarrassment, because these guys basically have said, we can't go there. We have to protect ourselves from prosecution, and if patients suffer, it's horrible, but it's just too bad.
That sounds like pretty unscrupulous medical behavior.
I'm sure
it does happen. And I can see partly how it's getting fed, because if you look over the headlines that came out discussing the new CDC guidelines not long ago, these headlines say things like doctors warn to stop prescribing opiates. So Certainly any prescriber is getting headline warnings before they go any deeper into what the actual standards are.
Right. And worse, or not worse, but at least as a part of that entire matrix, it is not at all clear to me that we have any reliable national database that establishes the numbers of people who actually do abuse prescription drugs or die from it. There was a fascinating article published, and I won't quote it at length because it is just that.
Yeah, actually, be brief, because I want to ask you another very important question in a minute. So go ahead.
Okay. A doctor who published an article, basically. The phrase that I think he used was an inconvenient truth. This guy is a pharmacist, and he points something out, which is that, and it does use some of the statistics that you, I think, are also running into in your online search work. He says that more than 99% of prescriptions for opioids are written for non-abusers. Should all of those prescriptions have been written? Probably not. But that doesn't change the fact that most of those patients aren't abusing opioids. The 14,000 related deaths to deaths related to opioid overdose is 14,000 too many. But the indications are that over 2 million prescriptions have now been written. 14,000 in 2 million, you can add it up yourself, it is a tiny fraction of 1%. And yet, The prevailing climate on this issue is being set by the hysterical repetition of the term epidemic. And I believe it is hysterical. I believe it isn't founded on sound statistics, and in fact, that we don't have sound statistics on how many people abuse opioids, even though they do have addictive potential. There are certainly some people who do. I won't claim that, to the contrary. But is it dominant in this population? I don't believe it. I flat do not believe it. I've talked with too many pain patients over the years who successfully
used... Let me interrupt,
because
I got a couple of things I want to get into. One is, we are getting, it seems, certain cluster reports of overdoses from heroin. And we need to distinguish the completely illegal use of drugs from large doses being prescribed by physicians. They're very, very different phenomena. Is that part of what you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the other thing to realize is that those large doses are also being influenced by the fact that the number of pain management practices has been shrinking, and it has been for years, because the liability issues are too high. You have no idea how much it costs a pain management physician in insurance for malpractice.
Okay.
But you can't
let me
get
ask you,
malpractice.
Let me get a couple of other things in that I wanted to bring up. Now, it seems to me that most of the routinely used opiates are now generic, so that in general, the opiate marketplace doesn't have a lot of drug company pushing for it. Am I right about that? I mean, there are drugs like
agree.
Fentanyl. I don't know if fentanyl is generic yet. Perhaps you
well,
do. But mostly these are generic
sure,
drugs
but,
without a big lobbying group to promote them.
Right. Norco, for instance, I believe is now generic. And Norco is very widely used. So I would say
that's the antidote, right?
No, Norco is a narcotic.
Okay. And that's a new one?
No, that one I think has been around for a while. I'd have to go double check to be sure I haven't mashed something in my head as far as the proper...
Okay.
Description or a proper drug name, but there, I would say on balance that most of the opioids that are in common use as prescriptions have been around for long enough that they are available in generic. And I'm certain that doctors that are keeping their patients' interests in mind would start with the generics because they're much less expensive, and pain patients are typically financially in desperation because they get many of them can't
work. Let me
interrupt.
Narcan is the opiate antidote, but that's not what you're referring to.
No. Norco, okay. I believe it is, I want to say hydrocodone, but I'm not absolutely sure. It's
oh,
true.
Okay. It's just one of the, I mean, those are, I understand. Yeah. Norco is acetaminophen and hydrocodone. But,
right.
But that's generic now. I mean, you can get all that stuff generic. There's no doubt
right.
about that. So
the pharmaceutical
I think,
companies
so I think
have
that, I just want to say for the folks that are listening, I think that one of the issues here is what I began with, that the lobbying by pharmaceutical industries, which is one of the most powerful forces in our society now, is not behind the use of opiates for pain medication. It's behind all the substitute drugs that go into that. But let me address one other thing before we finish. You and I both know, and I think we have to deal with this, and I'd like to you deal with it as best you can in a short period of time. We both know that there is a huge problem with giving increasing amounts of opiates for pain, because the body fights back, and you get the very same thing you get with all drugs, which is as you give a drug that dulls one of the brain's responses, the brain revs up its response. So to some extent, you're creating a pain response when you keep giving opiates. Are we agreed on that?
You definitely. There, and that has implications for practice. The reality
yes.
is that nobody should be on opiates who isn't managed actively on them.
Okay, because there is this risk. And what happens then if you try to come off the opiates is you not only have opiate withdrawal to deal with, you have more pain than you ever had before to deal with. Just like when you come off psychiatric drugs, you end up with more emotional distress than you had before you started them. Because yep. The brain has been fighting the drug and you're going into the withdrawal and those suppressed emotions are coming out. So that is, we want to acknowledge that there is a problem with managing pain by giving more and more opiates so that you get up into these 100 or 200 milligram equivalents to morphine, which is, you know, what does go on and one of the things the CDC is complaining about. So right. We're together on that, right?
There is a genuine problem there. There is a genuine problem there. But the thing that is missing from the public discussion is that large numbers of patients are treated with opioids as one element of a total management plan, and it's often with other medications as well, and are stable on managed prescriptions for years. Patients do not automatically spiral down into a cycle of deeper and deeper dependency and tolerance for drugs. It doesn't happen that way. And doctors who say it does happen that way do not have a scrap of science to justify that conclusion. So what we've got is hysteria ruling in the place of real science. And that needs to be done and put an end to. We need to you realize there is not one study, at least as far as I know there isn't, and I've been digging hard to find them, there is not one study that establishes the long-term effectiveness of opioids for treatment periods exceeding a year. There is nothing published for that.
All right, now this is important because I really want you to emphasize it because we've been talking much more about almost the opposite kind of issue. So the long-term use of opiates, there isn't a lot of scientific justification for.
Right. A different way of stating it. The long-term use of opioids is essentially a default condition because nothing else works. But what is really dangerous here is that conclusions are being reached about opioid dependence that don't have any studies behind them.
Richard A. Lawhern, we're getting to the end. The music tells me it's time to go. So listen, I'm so glad to have you on. It's Richard A. Lawhern, L-A-W-H-E-R-N, PhD in engineering. He's an inspiration for what a person can learn and do without being a qualified member of the establishment. And the information you have is extremely valuable. Thanks for being on the show.
Glad to help out.